We're joined on the line now by Federico Fuentes. Federico is the editor of a new book published by Resistance Books, Ukraine Resists, Left Voices on Putin's War, NATO and the Future of Ukraine. Thanks so much, first of all, for joining us today, Fred.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak on your program.
Now, I wanted to start literally at the beginning with a quote from the very first line of your introduction to the book, Federico, in which you write, and I quote, "The ongoing war in Ukraine, triggered by Russian President Vladimir Putin's decision to invade, is arguably the most important geopolitical event to confront the world since the collapse of the Soviet Union. Beyond the devastating destruction unleashed by Russia's invasion and the heroic fight back of the Ukrainian people, the war represents the opening salvos in a new period of increased militarization, intensifying great power rivalry, heightened conflict over spheres of influence, and greater domination of oppressed nations," end quote. I'm glad you started the book by framing it in such a way, because it's worth clarifying to our own listenership, some of whom may have wondered why I, for instance, have devoted a good deal of time and energy on this show to the Russo-Ukrainian war, having done a number of editorials and interviews on the conflict. And some of our listeners may wonder why we've devoted so much time and energy to it, particularly in the recent context, for instance, of a number of other very serious developments in the world. We have a whole series of bushfires in Greece and Portugal. We have climate change catastrophe. We've had coups in Niger and Gabon, a war in Sudan, Israeli attacks in the West Bank and Gaza. So there's a whole range of conflicts and developments throughout the world that, of course, we ought to be devoting attention to as well. But I agree with, you know, having said all that, I agree with that sentiment that you've expressed there, Fred, that this is the conflict to keep an eye on, if you like, given the gravity and the danger of it in the longer term. So to summarise all of those comments, in your view, why is the Russo-Ukrainian war so important, and what are the long-term, or at least the potential long-term global ramifications of the conflict?
Yeah, I think you start to gather the importance of this conflict when you go back to the days just prior to the invasion, and where it was almost unanimous, really, amongst a lot of the media, not all of it, but a lot of the media, but also amongst peace activists, those who are interested in fighting for a better world. The sentiment that there just would be no way that Russia would invade, that this was all just US propaganda, that, you know, Russia would never go and do something like that. And I can kind of understand why. I mean, I think I was, you know, pretty much in that boat myself. And I think it's because for the, you know, most of the last, let's say, 30 years, 20 years, the, you know, global geopolitics has largely just been dominated by US wars abroad, whether direct wars or indirect wars, aimed at maintaining itself as the main, you know, as being referred to, the sort of superpower or the sole global hegemon in the world. And in that context, you know, most conflicts were pretty clear-cut. It was pretty simple. You knew that the US and with its allies, like Australia, were going to wars. Of course, never going to wars for the so-called stated reasons, whether they were to bring democracy to Afghanistan or whether it was weapons of mass destruction. They were always wars of, you know, attempts to, you know, enforce US domination, hegemony around the world, and of course in recent periods, in particularly in the Middle East. But what we're seeing now is that really there's been a shift in world politics. It doesn't mean that the US doesn't remain the biggest power in the world. I think I think there's quite a lot of evidence that it still is. There's also quite a lot of evidence that its power, particularly its military power, you know, is suffering some weaknesses, and we saw that for the fact it's been forced to withdraw from Afghanistan 20 years after it went in, and with very little having changed in Afghanistan. And instead what we've seen is the rise of other powers who perhaps are not necessarily wanting to directly challenge the US for that sort of top dog role, superpower role, but certainly wanting to flex their muscles in their region and trying to carve out their spheres of influence, their spheres where they want to say, well, look, you know, what happened to you is what we say, and no one else is allowed to butt in.
Mm.
And the Ukraine war has really brought that to a fore. Now, of course, actually, we kind of forget, but there was actually a really important example that happened only a month before the Ukraine war. which was in Kazakhstan, where Russian troops also went into Kazakhstan, this time not in terms to invade, to crush the workers' revolt against the government, which is aligned to Russia there. Now, of course, in that context, there was no international uproar about that, about the murders that occurred as part of that military intervention, because, as I said, it was a workers' uprising, so in general, most governments are not particularly interested in supporting workers' uprisings anywhere. But it showed that Russia decided, look, they sense that the US is on the decline. They sense that NATO, its members in Europe and the US are divided about, you know, what does this all mean for the world today? So they've struck out. And this striking out, as I said, is really just the beginning of a number of other battles that are to come. And you've well outlined how these now are playing out all over the world, whether it's in the string of coups that have occurred in Africa, whether it's over the contested, increasing contestation that's occurring much closer to our area, whether it's in Taiwan or in the South China Sea. We're going to see this happening more and more. And so being able to clarify what are the different forces involved in these conflicts, how should peace activists respond to these conflicts? Because it's really going to require us to get a sense of this new situation and go beyond just simple slogans of peace now, or, you know, the US is always responsible for everything. Because actually when we look at the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the US didn't, you know, they're not the ones they're invading. It's a different country. So now we've got to figure out, well, how do we then, you know, grapple with that, and what sort of peace movement can we build?
I think you've outlined very well there, Fred, why the Russo-Ukrainian war is of such central importance to all of us as internationalists throughout the world. It is the central cog, if you like, around which a number of other cogs interconnect, including, you've mentioned, the coups in West Africa and a number of other conflicts as well. And you've painted a very good broad brushstrokes, a picture of those global geopolitical changes that are taking place in the world system. Getting now more specific to the origins of the war, and this is, of course, a very thorny, complex question, and it's where we begin to enter some of the differences and debates that have emerged on the left across the world. And we don't have time, certainly, to cover all of the, you know, antecedents and causal factors behind the war. But there is broad agreement that the origins can be found, at least in recent times, in the Euromaidan protests of late 2013. Very briefly, the pro-Russian president of Ukraine, Viktor Yanukovych, had vacillated on the question of developing closer relations with the European Union. He had initially agreed to sign the European Union-Ukraine Association Agreement. He then reneged on that under pressure from Putin. And there were protests, and this is where the debate already begins. Were they protests against that EU-Ukraine Association Agreement, or were they protests against corruption or for democracy, against Russian influence? You know, there's a number of factors involved. But in the end, Yanukovych was overthrown and fled into exile in Russia. And what immediately prompted his overthrow was the massacre of some 100 protesters in the Maidan Square, many protesters killed by snipers. A very violent repression of those protests. Yanukovych eventually replaced by the so-called chocolate billionaire Petro Poroshenko, who became president until Zelensky took over. And he did sign that EU-Ukraine Association Agreement. The point of all this being that there is at least one interpretation that this was seen as a threat to Russia, a direct threat, a part of the expansion of European and NATO influence into Ukraine, traditionally so-called Russia's sphere of influence. So this is the backdrop, and these events then lead to the annexation of the Crimean Peninsula by Russia, as well as the outbreak of war in Luhansk and Donetsk. In the Donbass region, with the emergence of these so-called people's republics backed by Russia. So there's a lot there, Fred. But what are the sort of common threads, if you like, in those prior events, those, you know, antecedents to the war that then takes the full-scale war that begins in 2022?
Yeah, look, I think there's a number of them, and you know to mention the book. I mean, a lot of these are covered in the book, where we speak to interview socialists in the countries directly involved in all of these processes, whether it be in the Ukraine, whether it be in Ukraine, in Russia, in Poland, in Norway, in terms of the push that's been occurring in Nordic countries to join NATO. And I think what becomes clear is that it's not possible to really understand what's going on today with simply a simplistic idea that this is all just about NATO expansion. Now, obviously, objectively, NATO expansion did occur following the collapse of the Soviet Union. There was quite a number of countries that joined NATO. But of course, throughout that time, Russia largely had no issues with those countries joining NATO, and quite often stated that it had no problem with Ukraine joining NATO or Georgia joining NATO. Said it was up to those countries to decide what they wanted, you know, where they would fit in into this process. And whilst NATO expansion certainly had one eye on Russia, what's become very clear is actually that for the US, it was largely a way to try to draw Europe more into its sort of sphere of domination, a sort of attempt to really cohere and cajole Europe. And we've seen that actually in the last few years, particularly under Trump, actually, really trying to push Europe to pull its weight in terms of the funding that goes to NATO. So that happens, but that doesn't really explain Russia's actions. I think if we look at that period, we see, as I said, Russia having quite open for countries joining NATO. In fact, at certain points, wanting to join NATO itself. At other points, doing joint military operations with NATO, allowing NATO to use Russian air bases as part of its war on Afghanistan, and participation as well in the war in Iraq. So the relationship is a much more complex one. But what we see is that in 2014, is that Russia decides much more than opposition to Ukraine joining the EU. What it really decided was that it now could no longer tolerate or felt that Ukraine was no longer making decisions that were not being largely determined by Moscow. That was really the big turning point for Russia. It was the sense that they no longer had, if not direct, certainly at least indirect control over the government in Kiev. And so it felt that it needed to respond to that. It needed to send a clear message, just as it had done to other countries in the region, that it would not tolerate independent regimes, whether that be independent because they choose to join the EU, whether that be independent because they choose to join NATO, whether it be independent because they choose to have a protest to overturn undemocratic elections or a workers' uprising against a corrupt regime. None of these would, you know, for Moscow, for the Kremlin, was something that could be tolerated. And that's then what really drives the process that occurs after 2014. Of course, there's a lot of blame that can also be put on the NATO countries for not having dealt with the situation in a much different manner to what they did.
Now, I did want to, I know you've addressed the question already, Fred, but I did want to go over it again in a little more detail, if for no other reason than to play devil's advocate for those people on the left who do blame this war entirely on NATO. You've mentioned NATO expansion, and for the benefit of the listeners, there has been a long period of enlargement of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. In 1999, Poland, Hungary and the Czech Republic joined. In 2004, Bulgaria, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, so all the Baltic states, Romania, Slovakia and Slovenia, later joined by Albania, Croatia, Montenegro and North Macedonia. And of course, ironically enough, the full-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine has led to Finland, a long-term neutral country throughout the Cold War, joining NATO, and Sweden's membership is currently still pending. Now, there is a famous incident that actually goes back in terms of the background of NATO expansion, which is that it's alleged that George Bush Sr.'s Secretary of State, James Baker, said to Mikhail Gorbachev in a meeting on February 9th, 1990, that, quote, NATO will not expand one inch eastward, or not one inch eastward. And that so-called gentleman's agreement that was never written down or codified or documented is seen as, it, at least by some people on the left, as if you like, the singular point of origin of this war, you know, 32, 33 years later, that the US had made a promise to the then collapsing Soviet Union not to expand American, European military influence, you know, up to Russia's borders, and yet that influence, the military sphere of influence, has extended up to Russia's borders. So sort of repeating the same question, I guess, Fred, but is there no kind of merit or credibility to that argument, you know, that Russia, that Putin really did feel threatened with NATO expanding all the way up to Russia's borders?
Well, I mean, again, the problem is, you know, anyone can just pick one single isolated incident and then try to assess everything that's happened since on the basis of one conversation that's been had in private. I mean, I could turn around and simultaneously say, well, you know, Putin in the early 2000s publicly declared that he had no problems with Ukraine and Georgia joining NATO. So why is that declaration any less important than the other one. There's also been a large number of, as you mentioned, countries that have joined NATO, most of which don't border Russia, so they're not actually expansion in terms of encircling Russia. They're just countries in other parts of Europe that have joined. And at those points, Russia has made no noise about it. In fact, they made no noise about Sweden and Finland, who do actually, you know, in their cases, have share borders with Russia joining NATO. So to reduce it all to just that issue, I think fundamentally misunderstands what's going on. So, yes, we can say that there's an element there that NATO expansion has not helped the situation, but NATO is a military bloc. I mean, in a world today, the creation of an expansion of any military bloc is a bad thing, because it moves away from a world where diplomatic disputes are resolved in, you know, negotiations, in courts, and that kind of thing, towards might versus might, you know, sort of force versus force situation. So in that general sense, that is an issue, but it doesn't really explain why Russia invaded Ukraine. And one only has to look at the speeches Putin made as he launched his invasion. The word NATO just doesn't exist. He doesn't talk about NATO as his explanation for invasion. He talks about how Russian and Ukrainians are one and the same people, that it was all a mistake that the Bolsheviks had created Ukraine and separated it off from Russia, and then it was part of the historic mission, or his historic mission, to reunite these people in one country. And he's done that through his invasion. I mean, taking a third of, you know, roughly a third of Ukraine and annexing it and putting it part of Russia. How this in any way stops NATO expansion? The irony is that Russia's border is now crept much closer to NATO by that annexation of 30% of Ukraine's southeast territory.
Now, coming to the full-scale invasion itself, as you've mentioned there, Fred, on February 24th, you know, hundreds of thousands, or I think it was 140,000 troops in the initial invasion wave, are descending from Belarus and from existing bases in the Donbass, as well as from Voronezh and the Southern Military Headquarters district in Rostov-on-Don, which became sort of the central command hub for the Russian invasion, as well as forces moving up from Crimea. So a multi-front war opened up on a full scale, with the main invasion force, this now famous 40-mile column, preceded by an aerial assault, an attempt to take the Hostomel airport just outside Kiev in an attempt. Well, that was the key strategic component of an attempted lightning assault on the capital, and to overthrow the Zelensky government. We know famously that assault, which some people think Putin thought the war would be over in 10 days, that it was a spectacular failure, the direct assault on the capital, even though it was probably a closer run thing than many Western military commentators would care to admit, the assault on Kiev. But nevertheless, it fails. Colossal human suffering. And this is, I suppose, where the problems, if you like, begin on the left in terms of the way that we respond to the war. So some people on the left immediately put this in a kind of a simple category, that this is an inter-imperialist proxy war. It's a plague on both houses, that Ukrainians are being used as pawns in a US attempt to weaken Russia and keep it in its corner, so to speak. So some people are saying this is nothing but an inter-imperialist war. Others saying, no, this is a war of independence and self-determination, you know, for the people of Ukraine. So, again, these are big, broad topics, Fred. But why do some people, you know, or on the left, or just people generally, almost dismissive of this war, and that we shouldn't be supporting the Ukrainian right to self-defense? But other people very clear on the fact that actually, yes, this is a war of self-defense.
Yeah. Well, look, I, again, you know, as the interviews in the book show, in the book Ukraine Resists, what they show is that the concrete events entirely contradict the idea that somehow this was a US provocation that led to the war, or that this is simply a sort of a proxy war. Because certainly if your intention is to provoke a war, then one should at very minimum be prepared to respond when the war begins. But what we saw in the days when Russia invaded was far from a unanimous response from the US to back Ukraine. Was quite the opposite. Was the US telling Zelensky that he should leave the country in order to form a government in exile and leave it up to partisans to see if they would be able to confront the invasion, that he shouldn't actually fight back? But instead it was the Ukrainian people themselves who resisted and pushed back that initial invasion on March on Kiev that you outlined. was only as a result of that brave, heroic struggle by the Ukrainian people, who weren't fighting for NATO, they weren't fighting for other imperialist governments. They're fighting for their lives because they knew what Russian occupation meant. They've had sections of their country under Russian occupation since 2014. That brave, heroic wave of resistance is what then forced other countries to think, okay, well, what do we do now in this new situation that we had not planned for in any way? It's all we've seen is that, of course, subsequent to that, certain imperialist governments have sought to see how they could advance the interests. Then everyone knows that the US doesn't supply Ukraine with weapons because it's something that comes from their deep belief in democracy or struggles for self-determination. I mean, few countries have crushed more struggles for self-determination than the US has in its history. So it's clearly not just providing these weapons with good intentions. It's doing it because it feels that it can weaken a country that it sees as a rival. But none of that takes back from the simple fact that the Ukrainians are clearly fighting a just war of self-defense against an invasion force that's carrying out a process of assimilation and genocide. And just, what the interviewers say is that, well, in that fight, you must support those that are fighting against assimilation and genocide. I mean, that seems like a principle that any leftist should uphold. And in the context of a war, the only way, unfortunately, you can fight back is by weapons. And to say one last point, the only place Ukraine can today get weapons is from those imperialist
governments. And I'm sorry to interrupt there, Fred, but you've raised, I think, a very important question, one which, and I have to say, I personally, struggle with in terms of what is the correct position, as much as it matters what my position is. And this is about the Ukrainian people, not what I think. And I think that in itself is an important point to point out, that we can have our own opinions and views and analyses of the Russo-Ukrainian war, but ultimately we ought to have front and centre in our hearts and our minds and our souls, the suffering of the Ukrainian people. And I think that's, if you take anything away from this interview, that ought to be the central point. But, insofar as we do have different positions, one thing that I struggle with is this question of Western military arms to Ukraine. So we can have the abstract position of supporting the right to self-defence. But if we concretely, for instance, address the question of Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese's supplying of Bushmaster infantry fighting vehicles, I think that very concretely raises the question of what do we say about Australian militarism, or what do we say about the fact that this war has in some ways legitimised militarism and the drive to war in the West, and are we running the risk of falling into the trap of indirectly supporting that militarism by, for instance, not being critical of Australia supplying those Bushmasters, even though at one level, those Bushmasters are providing assistance to the Ukrainian people in their fight for self-determination.
Well, I think what we have to do is separate the two things out, and it shouldn't be very difficult. I mean, certainly there's a number of historical precedents where governments have provided military aid, obviously not necessarily for good intentions, but provided military aid to struggles that required those in order to win their just battles. To give one example, a historic example, in the United States, in the Japanese invasion and war against China, provided China with a huge amount of military aid in that just struggle of the Chinese against Japanese imperial occupation. Now, of course, the US did that because it saw Japan as a rival. But at that time, socialists had no problems with understanding that if you support armed resistance against occupying force, then you can't stand in the way of that armed resistance receiving the weapons that it needs to carry out that armed resistance. The support is completely meaningless. So what we have to do, though, in our country is make it clear and separate out that the fact that whilst we do not oppose these weapons going to the Ukrainians, because we explain that the Ukrainians are fighting a just war of independence, of self-determination, we simultaneously make it clear that the Australian government is not doing this on the basis of wanting to support genuine self-determination. And we can point out the hypocrisy of the Australian policy, for instance, all over the Pacific in terms of struggle for self-determination there. show that, yeah, it's a lie when the Australian government says that this is the reason it's providing the weapons. But we can also simultaneously say that if we want to move towards a world where these kind of wars are not necessary, then we need to think through a different way of foreign policy, and increased militarism and military box is not that way forward. So we can, there's no contradiction in my mind at all in saying that we fundamentally oppose and will continue to campaign against something like AUKUS, the Australian-UK-US military alliance, because it does nothing to bring about peace. But at the same time, say that it is absolutely fine and justifiable to allow the Ukrainians to seek the weapons they need to also fight for their just peace, a struggle that ultimately will advance the course of peace in the world today. Because let's be honest, history shows that when imperial invaders, be they Russia, be they the US, be they any country, successfully carry out one invasion and occupation, it usually isn't the last one. It usually becomes then the trigger for more and more conflicts. So if we're serious about a world that without war, serious about a world for self-determination, if we're serious for a world for peace, then we should support all we can the Ukrainian struggle, while simultaneously pointing out hypocrisy and campaigning at home against our government's policies that seek to create more war and militarism elsewhere in the world.